This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The podcast Suspect Convictions looks at the physical evidence in the case of Christina McNeil, and it's frustrating.
How on earth do you go back and look at photographs from 20 years ago and read a report written by another doctor as a physician, come up with any conclusion one way or the other that's definitive?
Another episode in Suspect Convictions with journalist Scott Reeder, plus the Canadian band Simply Saucer plays Bloomington Normal. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. When prosecutors accused Barton McNeil of murdering his daughter, their theory about his motive hinged on physical evidence showing the three-year-old was sexually assaulted prior to her death. Now, as McNeil's Illinois Innocence Project defense team works toward his exoneration, new questions are being raised about whether any sexual assault ever took place. That's where episode 3 of GLT's true crime series, Suspect Convictions, begins.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. Three-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Christina!
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. With investigative journalist Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. Prosecutors believe that 3-year-old Christina McNeil was killed in her Bloomington, Illinois apartment 19 years ago after being sexually assaulted. Although Barton McNeil was never charged with sexually assaulting his daughter, the accusation held heavy during the 1999 bench trial, which resulted in a murder conviction and a 150-year prison sentence for Barton McNeil. Since the day of Christina's death, Barton has contended that his girlfriend, Masuk Nolan Wang, with whom he had just ended a relationship, killed his daughter. When an autopsy performed the day after the murder indicated the child had been sexually assaulted, McNeil blamed Masuk for that crime as well.
I did not kill my only child, okay? I have never had an impure thought about her or about any other child ever in my life. And if I had, I would have ended my relationship with my daughter right then and there.
Barton McNeil was sent to prison, and Masuk Nolan married Don Wang. But 12 years after Barton McNeil was imprisoned, Don Wang filed for a divorce from Masuk. She retaliated by luring his mother to Bloomington, Illinois, beating and strangling her to death, boxing her body in a plastic tub, and burying her 90 miles away. In 2012, Masuk Wang was convicted of this murder and sentenced to 50 years in prison, a term she's currently serving. We want to make absolutely sure that you understand the intensely graphic nature of what you're about to hear. Unfortunately, this child murder case also includes the very real possibility of sexual assault, and that will be discussed. Since that conviction in 2012, many have contended Masuk Wang is responsible for Christina McNeil's death as well. But prosecutors say since Christina was sexually assaulted, then it follows that it was a man who committed the crime. The pathologist found swelling around the child's rectum and pubic area, suggesting she had been penetrated with an object. No semen was recovered. But Barton McNeil's legal representatives contend sexual assault may never have taken place. Gwen Jordan is with the Springfield, Illinois-based Illinois Innocence Project. She tells Suspect Convictions Scott Reeder, 21st century forensic science may hold important clues.
There used to be, around the time that Christina was killed, a sense of thought that if the orifices on the body were enlarged, like the anus or the vagina, that that meant that there was sexual abuse or sexual assault. And the prosecutor, although they never ever charged Bart with this, used that as a theory of motivation, why Bart committed this crime, because they said to the judge at the trial that he had sexually assaulted her and therefore was covering it up, even though they never charged him with this. And of course, there was no semen anywhere. And the pathologist even testified that there had been no penetration. But because there was redness and because the orifices were enlarged, the pathologist asserted that that was evidence of sexual assault. Again, that evidence has been completely discredited by scientists today. What they know is that the natural process of rigor mortis means that the orifices open. So an enlarged orifice doesn't mean that there was any sort of sexual misconduct. It means that the body had died and rigor mortis is setting in. So the theory that the prosecutor used originally has been discounted by changes in science. The tunnel vision that the police officers got because they believed that Bart was lying has been discredited.
You're tuned to Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with investigative journalist Scott Reeder, and we're looking at the death of three-year-old Christina McNeil in June of 1998 in Bloomington, Illinois. Scott, that was tough to listen to. This aspect of this little girl's death is very troubling, and it's very hard to discuss publicly, even privately, but we're really, really compelled to do that because we want to try and get at exactly what happened here. So we kind of have to look at this horrible situation, and that is the accusation that Christina McNeil may have been sexually assaulted right before and maybe several times before her death.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Willis. I'm the father of three girls. The subject matter just literally makes my skin crawl. I mean, I just don't like talking about it. I don't like thinking about it. But this is a really critical issue in the case, and we really need to look at it and examine it hard because you have the prosecution essentially saying the reason they believe Bart did this murder is to cover up the sex abuse that was going on. That was the case, at least they made 20-some years ago. So I guess you have to ask yourself a lot of tough questions. One is there sufficient evidence that sex abuse took place? But two, if sex abuse took place, why would you assume that Bart was the person who did it and not somebody else?
It's a logical question because Barton McNeil and his team of supporters are pointing a finger at Masuk Wang in this particular case as if there was any sexual assault that occurred, it was perpetrated by Masuk, and that Masuk eventually entered the apartment that night and killed Christina McNeil. So it's something that we do have to look at here. And so now I guess we have to determine if the girl was sexually assaulted, was it by her father, as the prosecution alleged, and successfully used as a way of arguing for his conviction back in 1998? Or was it, as Barton McNeil attests, that it was his then-just-dumped girlfriend, Masuk Wang, who committed the sexual abuse and the murder? I guess we're, for purposes of stating the case here, we're nailing it down to those two people.
It would sure seem that way. Or at the very least, if it could have been somebody, you know, if some Masuk was with somebody. But for all intents and purposes, it was either Bart or somebody, Masuk or somebody connected with her, I mean, that would have done this. It seems to be the most likely scenario we can come up with here.
In other words, we're not talking about some random burglar who broke into the house and committed a murder and sexual assault, because neither side in this case suggests that was a scenario.
One of the questions that's worth asking now is, did sex abuse happen here? You know, you have Gwen Jordan saying their expert says he doesn't think sex abuse happened. Of course, the prosecution saying exactly the opposite. I think it's interesting that the prosecution isn't letting us anywhere near their expert. They aren't even giving out the name of him, or her, for that matter. The defense doesn't want us anywhere near their expert to talk to him. We do know that he lives in Minnesota and he's dying. This is very frustrating to me. I mean,
it sounds to me like you have some doubt about whether or not she was sexually assaulted.
Well, I wouldn't quite say it that way. What I would say is, how on earth do you go back and look at photographs from 20 years ago and read a report written by another doctor as a physician, come up with any conclusion one way or the other that's definitive? I mean, to me, you're not going to really know a whole lot unless you examine the body. And, you know, a photograph is never going to replace actually seeing and palpating the body and examining things. I guess I don't really trust a diagnosis made by anyone 20 years after the fact by just looking at pictures.
So here's a question for you then, Scott. Why don't they exhume Christina's body? And I know that's an expensive process. It costs a lot of money. Who's going to pay for it? The defense side, the prosecution. Can they do that?
You know, that thought crossed my mind too. But we found out that she was cremated. And, you know, it's kind of a weird story that goes along with this. I talked to Chris Ross, who's Bart's cousin, and he told me this story.
Christina's body was cremated at the request of her mother, Tita McNeil, who was the sole legal guardian. And Barton's attorney had initially arranged for a well-known defense pathologist to inspect the body. An appointment was set. However, a judge and the public defender's office and apparently Tracy Smith, Bart's attorney, all agreed that Tita McNeil's wishes would be followed upon and the body would be cremated before a defense pathologist was able to review the body.
So how did Bart feel about this?
Bart, I know, was incensed. He could not believe that a defense pathologist was not called in to inspect the body. This was, you know, completely, he would never have agreed to this. He knew that to completely rely upon only the report as prepared by the prosecution's office would be to his detriment.
So a key question remains, if sexual abuse took place, does it necessarily point to Bart McNeil? Scott, you asked that question in a recent interview with John Hanlon, executive director of the Illinois Innocence Project, which intends to file public motions in the McNeil murder case.
Why would they assume that it was Bart that did that as opposed to Masuk or some other intruder in the home? I mean, what was it about Bart that made him the more, to be the person that was assumed to be the sex offender?
Well, the immediate focus upon Bart McNeil is in part due to a phenomenon that we consistently have referred to as tunnel vision, but which now maybe more frequently is referred to as confirmation bias. We have a theory as to why things happen, and then we work to confirm that theory. And the tunnel vision that's involved in a situation like this, I'm sure virtually any police agency officer would agree, is that if a child has been abused or injured or killed in their home, you look inside the home first. And so the immediate theory became, Bart was home. Christina was there with him. There was no other apparent person inside. And so we are going to immediately default to our standard, long-standing belief that that's how these things happen. And in part, that was further based on the idea that Bart, a man who, you know, was up late at night, you know, perhaps engaged in a chat room, that sort of thing, and therefore that he is definitely more likely the one who did it because he's a man. He's interested in women, and he's advancing his prurient interests, and so of course he, as the man, would be the one who would do that. It's that type of thinking. It's the generalized kind of old school thinking that men commit sexual abuse and women don't. And of course, in this case, that theory fails for any number of reasons.
But do you think in the 1990s that was even more prevalent in the thinking?
Oh, sure, yeah. I don't think there's any question about it. Having been involved as a criminal lawyer in our system since 1983, some 34 years almost, you know, the number of female adult sexual abuse of children cases, you know, overall it's not an overwhelming number of cases. Therefore, the thinking becomes, well, it just doesn't happen.
Well, do you think that the reason we don't see a lot of these cases is because there's a confirmation bias out there among police not to investigate them because a woman is having been the perpetrator of this crime? So, yeah. You know, they may be disproportionately male, but even though those that are committed by women, they tend to get overlooked.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any question about that. It's ultimately these cases, remember, from the investigation police angle, these cases are ultimately going to involve persuasion of a jury or a judge. And the concept of accepting that a woman could do this, especially 20 years ago, and then persuading a jury that a small, petite female could engage in this kind of action against a child, it's pretty difficult, again, especially 20 years ago.
What do we really know about Masuk's background when she was in Korea, when she was growing up?
Well, we've heard a lot, a very serious talk and things to investigate and things that may or may not have happened. And so I think what we know is not a lot, but where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think some further work needs to be done to flush a lot of that out.
In order to determine whether or not it's logical in this day and age to limit suspicion of this kind of sexual abuse and assault to men, suspect convictions sought the input of some top experts. Franca Cortoni is a professor at the University of Montreal and an international expert on female sex offenders. She says a woman could have committed this crime.
We have a little bit of research that compares the range of acts a woman does versus a man. And what we see is that the women can engage in exactly the same full range of acts as a man does. However, the proportion that engages in penetration, whether with an object or other ways, is much less. So much less women proportionally engage in penetrative kind of behaviors compared to men.
Cortoni says while perceptions among police officers and the public have changed during the last 25 years, there are still some reticent to view women as potential sex offenders.
And we do know that, because there's been some research that's been done on public's attitudes, for example, and professionals' attitudes towards female sexual offending. And there's still very much the presence of this idea that, well, women can't do this. It's impossible that it would be a woman who'd do something like that. And it does impact on how professionals see not only potential offenders, but also potential victims. Because it's the same thing. Victims say, women assaulted me, and the response, unfortunately, hopefully it's getting better generally, but it's still like, oh, no, I mean, no, can't be. Are you sure? Well, I mean, it can't be. Your mother couldn't have abused you. Like, it can't be, right? And it's just like, so victims are confronted with that because the professionals have a hard time imagining that a woman can sexually offend.
Another expert, Havada Wakefield, a Minnesota forensic psychologist specializing in the study of sex offenders, adds that women who sexually abuse younger children almost universally share certain characteristics.
There have been several studies on them show that these women come from abusive, chaotic backgrounds. They're likely to have been abused themselves as children. And some of the studies show as high as 80% to 95% of these women came from that kind of background. They're likely to have mental health problems and alcoholism.
There are some signs Masuk Wang experienced this type of behavior in her formative years. In an interview aired during a television depiction of the murder which landed Masuk in prison, her daughter Michelle hinted at problems during her mother's upbringing.
Her upbringing wasn't the best. The black sheep is what she really basically felt like.
And when questioned about the possibility Masuk had murdered her mother-in-law, Michelle told Bloomington police her mother had a history of being abusive to her as well. An editor's note here, there are a few police redaction pauses included in this audio.
She, you know, abused me a lot if she got mad at my dad. Or
such as? How would she abuse you?
Like a paper towel, rolls, it's the wooden part. Nowadays they don't, you know, usually use them, but a really hard wooden stick. And, like, beat me, and times I would faint, you know, just black out. So I was abused a lot. You know, just whenever she beat me.
Where would she beat you at when she did it?
My aunt took photos, a lot of my legs, my arm, I know that. She never did it to my head.
How old were you?
I mean, it happened for so long, like, all the way when I was a little girl and she was married to my dad until she was with me. I don't know when she started it, you know what I mean, but all the way until I was up until about 8, until she got caught, you know. I don't know how to lie to them until I fell on the playground. Well, how did you fall here? And then, did you fall once? And I was just like, you know, little. And I'm like, yeah. And then they're like, well, how did you get, you know, the mark here? And that's when I cracked, and it's just, you know, like my mom's abusing me.
Current McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers recently hired a new forensic pathologist to review the autopsy report and photos in the Christina McNeil murder case. He is dismissive of the original pathologist's contention that Christina was penetrated in the rectum, but believes bleeding around the vulva indicates a sexual assault took place. However, because the hymen remained intact, penetration was not deep. Assistant State's Attorney Mary Cole has spent hours reviewing the Barton McNeil case.
So, I'm going to ask you a difficult question here. If there wasn't deep penetration, Mary, what exactly was the nature of the sexual assault that took place?
I don't want to speculate about that. I will just say that the pathologist in our written communications indicates that there had been some type of sexual assault which caused pressure in the vulvar area.
I know that during the police interview, at one point, they put Masuk and Barton in the same room, and he accused Masuk of using one of her vibrators on his daughter. Does that strike you as really odd, Mary, that he would say something like that?
My opinion, of course, about Barton's behavior doesn't matter, except to the extent that I think that his unusual comments, unusual behavior throughout the investigation is some evidence of his consciousness of guilt, his unusual attempts to divert attention and to control the investigation. I think shows that there's something more going on in his guilty mind than an innocent person.
Barton McNeil's cousin Chris Ross, who has been researching McNeil's case from his California home, paints Barton's conversation with police about Masuk's possible sexual abuse involvement this way.
When Bart was told that his daughter may have been sexually molested, you know, Bart immediately thought of Masuk and also knew that she owned a number of sexual aids. And so he told police this, and further, you know, told police that, you know, hey, if you put me in a room with Masuk, you know, I think I could get her to confess. And surprisingly, the police did just that. They took Bart upon his wish to confront Masuk and put them in the same room together the same day in which they're both being interviewed. This is the day after Christina's murder. And the first thing out of Bart's words are, you expletive molested my daughter, and you probably used one of your vibrators on her, didn't you? And of course, the little meeting between the two of them, you know, went downhill from there. And the police then excused Masuk and allowed her to go back to her apartment, having done nothing, only have learned that she owned these vibrators. And Masuk then could have easily gone home and cleansed them all with rubbing alcohol or whatever. And it wasn't until a day later that all of a sudden the police had kind of the aha revelation that maybe we need to do something about these vibrators that we just learned that Masuk owns and go retrieve them from her apartment, which they did.
Barton McNeil denies any alleged sexual abuse in connection with his daughter Christina's murder. He said the contention by prosecutors that he killed Christina so that others wouldn't learn he was sexually abusing her is ridiculous.
I think a very powerful case can be made that the sexual abuse evidence doesn't implicate me. It implicates Masuk, because it is she is the one who lost her any ability to continue to monitor Christina, to continue to threaten her or torment her or psychologically manipulate her in order to maintain the secret. So the fact that Christina was killed just hours after Masuk's access to her came to a complete end serves as a motive.
So Barton McNeil contends that Masuk's losing her access to Christina serves as a motive to Masuk killing her. Scott Reeder, what do you think about that concept?
I just don't know. It's such a weird case. But, okay, here's what runs through my mind is the prosecution argued 20 years ago that if Bart was sexually abusing Christina, then that was his motive for killing her because he wanted to cover up the sex abuse. To me, that doesn't make any sense because, okay, if you're somebody who is in this horribly manipulative process where you are abusing a child and keeping the child quiet, the last thing you want to do is kill the child and have her examined by physicians and a forensic pathologist and all of that. That's just going to draw attention to it. I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as that being a motive for killing a child. I just don't get it. I mean, obviously you're dealing with sick minds if whoever would have done something like this. But the thing that really perplexes me is, okay, what we do know from medical examiner's report was Christina's hymen was intact, that there's no evidence of deep penetration that took place. There was a redness around the vulva, maybe a little bit of bleeding or something on this small child. You know, what keeps going through my mind is, could that have been done with a vibrator? I mean, would that be an injury consistent with it being topically put on the child? I'm not an expert on those things, but it runs through my mind that maybe there's something here. I don't know. What do you think, Willis?
Well, neither one of us are experts, and I think at this point it's a good thing to say that. But here's a concern I have about this whole Barton killed her to cover up the sex abuse. We know now, through years and years of study of the relationship between an abuser and the victim, especially when we're talking about an adult and a child, there are loads of instances where an adult, say the uncle from the olden days or whatever, would intimidate the victim by threatening them not to talk, never to say this, or, you know, something's going to happen to you. But they didn't kill the person. They continued a lifelong of intimidation. Something like that could have happened here, I think, short of him actually going through and killing his daughter.
Yeah, I mean, we aren't pointing a finger at one person or the other, but it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense as far as the timing. If Bart was the perpetrator, to have drawn attention to the ongoing crime by killing his daughter, that just doesn't register with me. I mean, then you have to explain what happened to everybody, the police, the coroner, the child's mother. I mean, it just doesn't strike me as something you would do to cover something up, because it really doesn't cover anything up. Bart contends he was set up by his ex-girlfriend to make it look like something had happened. I mean, and, you know, I don't know. And that's the bottom line here, Willis, is we don't know.
So, Scott, we've heard from experts who have told us about the possibility of, could a woman do this? The answer seems to be, yes, a woman could, although a male is more likely to exhibit this type of behavior.
But, Willis, one of the things that, when they hear that, I get a little bit queasy here because, okay, we can also say that about murder. Well, we know that a woman can murder, but we know the statistics show a far, far higher percentage of murderers are men. So do you rule out all women as murderers because you know most murderers are men? Well, no, you don't do that.
And we also know that Masuk is a convicted murderer.
Exactly. We know she is a convicted murderer. I don't think there's any real significant question out there that she killed her mother-in-law in a horribly graphic way. So the question is, she is in that minority of murderers who are female. Could she be in that minority of sex offenders who are female? That's the question here. I mean, obviously she's done some very antisocial things in her lifetime. We just don't know for sure if this is one of them.
It remains to be seen how the potential sexual assault of Christina McNeil prior to her death could impact whether or not Barton McNeil is granted a new murder trial. Only one thing is certain right now. Both McNeil and the woman he accuses of killing his daughter remain in prison following murder convictions. Next time during Suspect Convictions, it's a roundtable discussion featuring two top true crime reporters.
I am there to bring light to a dark situation, that I'm there for catharsis for the family, that I'm there to find justice in a case where maybe justice hasn't been found, and that I'm there to make a difference.
We'll be joined by legendary true crime reporter and author Aphrodite Jones. And Bob Ruff from the podcast Truth and Justice will also weigh in on the mysterious death of Christina McNeil. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
Listen to new episodes each Friday on GLT Sound Ideas and at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions. You can also subscribe to Suspect Convictions on your favorite podcast app.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the proto-punk band Simply Saucer. Sharon McCauley is a name many in the community might recognize because of her work with State Farm's Military Affinity Group. That's an organization with roots stretching back to late 2001 when her son Chris joined the War on Terror and McCauley's co-worker sent cookies to his unit overseas. The effort evolved into the Adopt-a-Soldier program. State Farm employees would send care packages with personal items and the comforts of home along with letters from school children. By 2003, the MAG was an official group with units at other State Farm facilities across the nation. On the eve of Veterans Day, McCauley talks with GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds to announce her retirement from the company and the military support group.
I've been at State Farm 22 years, and right now I'm a systems project infrastructure coordinator. That sounds like a lot of words, but I work on different projects in the systems department.
Well, you sent out an email this week letting members of the military affinity group and community supporters know that you are going to be leaving State Farm, and so this will be your last Veterans Day.
I will. I'll be retiring from State Farm, and it's bittersweet to look back on, oh my goodness, everything we've accomplished. It's different when you're in the moment and you're working on something, but when you look back, it's mind-boggling the things that we've done because of the energy and the passion and the community support.
Well, let's first talk about your connection to the military. You have a son who served.
I do, and he still is. He has a couple years, so he can retire from the military.
As an organization, MAG has done a lot to support soldiers. Do you have a proudest moment?
Yes.
Among all of those efforts?
I absolutely do. I can't not mention some of these things. We built a Habitat house for a local military family. We raised half the cost of the house. We partnered with Country Finance, their veterans group, and Mitsubishi Veterans Group. We broke ground in, I think it was March, and we handed the keys over to the family right after Christmas. A deployed Navy reservist, he has four children, lives back here, said he didn't get to finish shingling his garage roof. I said, don't worry about it, we got it. We tore it completely down to the cement floor and rebuilt a brand new garage. When he came home, we had a big yellow ribbon around it, and all the volunteers were inside. We had Anchors Away playing. Everybody was crying.
The Habitat house went to
a local military family, Ignacio Barrientos and his family.
And you were part of the building?
Yes. I was part of all of it, fundraising, building, volunteers. We had a refreshment committee. And there were several Habitat house builds going on out there, and everybody knew when our group was bringing out refreshments because they all kind of huddled around because I don't think anybody else was as organized with refreshments. We met out there every Saturday, worked on the house, and had coffee. And one of the last Saturdays, it started to shape up to a house, and it was kind of muddy, and I was tracking in. I told his wife that I feel bad that I'm tracking into your house, into your home. And she put her arm around me. She said, this is your home, too. It was very moving. Incredible family, just incredible family.
So the kinds of support that you have lent is emotional support in various ways and also physical support, right?
Oh, absolutely. And what we've done, I consider it a labor of love. I don't see any work involved in it at all. This has led to so many other things. There's a group called Who Off for Heroes, and they're having a hunt this week. Last year, they brought up, I think it was 9 wounded soldiers, and 6 of them brought their wives because they're full-time caregivers. So I set up a ladies' spa day for them, and there are so many stories shared and tears were shared because they never get a day off. This community is, this is the most incredible community. All I have to do is go ask, what can we do and how can we help you? They gave each lady a manicure, a pedicure, a massage, a facial, and a haircut. I went to Schnucks and told them what I was doing, and they gave me a dozen red roses for each of the ladies for the husbands to give to their wives because they can't get out and do things like that.
And you've seen that with other efforts.
Oh.
I'm thinking of Operation Santa.
Operation Santa, yeah. Where do I start with that? To date, have shipped over 220,000 handmade Christmas stockings.
So many accomplishments. You must feel very proud of the work that you've been able to do.
I don't consider it me. I consider it the community because one person can't do this. People are good, basically good. They want to do something. But until you give them the avenue and you say, hey, I need shoes or I need Halloween candy or I need this, they're just overwhelmingly responding.
Through the Military Affinity Group, you also have personally come a long way, haven't you?
Oh, my. I can't even begin to tell you. And I think it's all when you are empowered by somebody who believes in you. And I have a mentor. I call her truly an angel unaware among us. I was very quiet. I grew up on the West Side. I thought I wasn't good enough. I didn't have anything to say. I wasn't worth listening to. But when you start something and you have somebody like I had who believed in you, who is, I don't have enough words for her, the most gracious person I've ever met. And to think that she thought I was okay. It's like, okay, I can keep going with this. You can do things. I'm living proof of that. Who would ever thought I would get to ride on the executive State Farm jet to go to Washington, D.C., that I would meet the president several times, that I would go to the State of the Union address. I'm living proof. Yes, you can. If you have something you're passionate about, go for it. Don't stop at the first no. I don't anymore. I don't even take no for an answer. I don't stop at the second or third no anymore.
So what happens when you leave State Farm? How do you channel all of your passions for helping soldiers? Will it take a different form, or will it, some of the people that you've met through partnerships, your work will support what they're doing?
I've made so many partnerships outside of there that I'm sure it's going to keep going. I'm looking into opportunities with the USO to help bring that down to Central Illinois. There's a lot of groups who offer heroes. I'll be helping them with that. I got to tell you this story. Sorry, I have a lot of stories. The first year we did it, they bring up wounded soldiers and they go out and hunt. It's very therapeutic for them. It's out at Funk's Grove. And they get away from their doctors and their medicines and all their medical troubles. We have dinner out around a campfire under the stars, and it culminates in a banquet the last night of the event. And at the first banquet, the sponsors got up and the supporters got up and spoke, and then one of the Marines who was up here, you know how burly Marines are and they're not supposed to cry, he got up and he said, you don't know it, but because of what you did, you just saved a couple lives this week.
We do know, last count, I think it was 22 suicides a day.
Yes.
Is it getting any better?
I still hear that number. I haven't heard it reduced.
Well, Sharon McCauley, you've done a lot in your time at State Farm. We know when you retire in March, you'll do many more good things to support soldiers, and we thank you.
I don't plan to stop, and I want to thank the community. This is the best, absolute best community. I want to thank the community for all your support, and you. You've been there since the beginning of Adopt-A-Soldier, so thank you.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds.
GLT is made possible by Illinois State University, the first public university in the state of Illinois. Since 1966, Illinois State has partnered with listeners and local business underwriters to bring you this public radio station. More information at illinoisstate.edu and wglt.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The decades ahead of its time proto-punk band Simply Saucer languished in obscurity during its 7 years of existence, never even releasing an album in that period. A decade after splitting, Cyborgs Revisited was released. It almost immediately became known as a lost Canadian classic and is now considered one of Canada's greatest rock recordings ever. GLT's John Norton has more with the band's founder in advance of their appearance tomorrow night at Riverbridge and Vine.
Electro Rock is the song. It's from the album Cyborgs Revisited from the mid-1970s. It's by the Hamilton, Ontario quartet Simply Saucer. The band's vocalist, guitarist, founder Edgar Bro joins us via Skype. Edgar, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, John.
You guys get lumped in with a lot of different influences and a lot of out of Detroit. The Stooges, MC5, Alice Cooper, but also the Velvet Underground out of New York City. First of all, were you looking at any of those groups I just mentioned when you were immersing yourself into the music scene?
Well, we were all inveterate record collectors, and we met at a local record bar. And one of the band members had seen the Velvet Underground in Toronto.
When you saw the Velvet Underground, did it hit you? I mean, I bet you were aware of their music, but when you saw them, how did it affect you?
No, I didn't. It was David. I formed the band with David Byers and Paul Colilli. It was David who saw the Velvet Underground. Oh. Although the Velvets had played in Hamilton in 1966, the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, they came to McMaster University. And we looked up the show on microfiche just to see what the reviews said. And the entertainment editor that saw them was completely baffled by the show.
Well, I would imagine you guys got some of that when you were playing at Hamilton as well, when Simply Saucer got rolling, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we got thrown off some stages. We played in Oakville, which is between Hamilton and Toronto, the 707 Club. We were about four songs into the set, and they pulled the plugs on us. Hmm. Our manager pretty well would book us anywhere, including high school proms.
Really? Are you serious? A prom?
Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah, a high school prom. And I remember the principal just of the school coming in after our first set, just begging us to turn down and tone it down a little bit. But
let's play,
which we did not do.
Yeah,
it was just the way we were.
You had integrity. That's great.
Yeah.
I mentioned the experimental nature of some of the music you were playing. It kind of like jazz.
Yeah, that's funny you should say that, John. Yeah, we did listen to jazz. We were listening to Coltrane, and we were listening to Sun Ra.
Yeah.
Coleman Hawkins. We had very diverse, eclectic tastes in music, so there was lots of different styles. I was a fan of Lightnin' Hopkins, and I was also into a lot of the English folk artists like Nick Drake and Pentangle, and some of the more free-form improvisational groups like the Third Ear Band. We loved the Soft Machine, so we were getting some jazz stuff from them and from Nucleus, which was an English kind of jazz rock fusion band. So there was a lot of jazz, and in a sense, our approach, although we didn't, I wouldn't say you could call us a jazz band, we weren't, but our approach was kind of a jazz approach in the sense that everyone was a soloist in the band, and we started out improvising. That was our sound. We would do long jam sessions, and we learned to improvise. And eventually, when I realized that I was a songwriter, what we did was we would encapsulate the improvisation within the songs that I would write. So it was just that kind of let's go for it when we soloed. And then, bring it back into the song structure. And that's kind of our sound in a way.
Talking with Edgar Bro, the founder, vocalist, guitarist in the band Simply Saucer, going to be at Reverberation Vinyl on Saturday night. I want to go back to the beginnings in a way, when you're bringing all these sounds, all these influences into what you're doing, did you know what you were doing? Did you know what you were trying to get out of yourself? Or were you, is it a total like, let's just really goof good, around and see?
That's a good question, John. Because, it was it took me a long time to really... we thought we had something different. Like for Hamilton, Ontario, for Canada, there weren't really any Canadian bands doing what we were doing. And but I think because we found it so difficult to make a go of it, playing that music, that it became something that when we crashed and burned in 1979, it took me a long while afterwards to disassociate the music from the lifestyle, because the lifestyle things, the dysfunctionality of the way we were living, had begun to supersede the music itself, and the scene we were involved in, it was more of a substance abuse party kind of scene.
Okay.
It just overshadowed everything, John. So it took me a long time to realize that what we had done and in terms of my songwriting, that it was an artistic something very cool artistically.
You're looking back today, or even maybe 10, 15 years ago, when you're looking back and things are starting to happen again, were you, I want to say pretty proud, but were you pretty happy or with what you had done? Did you?
Yeah, it was great, but I mean, it was kind of disturbing too, because it was hard to deal with. I had sold all my gear in 1979, and I bought a really high-end acoustic guitar because I was a big fan of John Fahey.
Yeah.
And I was doing open tuning fingerstyle guitar playing, and I had gone into like the singer-songwriter thing. And a lot of my influences, even back in the day in the 70s, were songwriters like Ray Davies and... I love John Cale, Nick Drake, and Syd Barrett, people like that. And all of them had that sort of... more eclectic kind of writing style, and I had gone in that direction. And when the critical acclaim came for the band, I felt very divided, and I wasn't sure that I could get my head wrapped around that music again and those lyrics, the sci-fi lyrics and that. So it was a bit of a learning experience, and this idea that I could be more than one thing, that it was all me. And that enabled me to play the music again and to, get my chops back as an electric guitar player.
Okay, let me go back on that. That's a really good point. These are lyrics and songs from 40-some years ago. You were in a different place mentally, I'm guessing. Did you wrap yourself around that to bring these songs back into your life and perform them?
I did a lot of thinking, about what had inspired those lyrics. And some of it was from, reading sci-fi and watching sci-fi movies and, certain kind of divisions that can happen to you when you're growing up. Yeah, it took quite a bit of thought and trying to understand myself, I suppose. I had really left the business, and I was homeschooling 5 children at one point. Like, we had 5 kids. So I was in a totally different world. And, sometimes I would see a video of bands later on who were becoming big bands and thinking, man, we were doing that in the 70s. And in a way, we were kind of even more out there, outsider than a lot of the bands that later on, did very well. So there was probably some bitterness, I have to admit, about how bad things had gone for us. It was like a snowball, John. And I wasn't on the internet at first, but people kept telling me that, you could search Simply Saucer and, find all these things being written about the band. But Chris Stigliano, who was a fanzine, he had a fanzine called Black to Calm out of Pennsylvania. He had a lot to do with spreading the word about Simply Saucer. So we had a lot of really good American press for the record when it was released. And So, yeah, I'm totally reconciled to it, and I've just completed my own, my third solo album. So it's just a different side of me. I have a two-track career going on, and I love playing with the band, and I have a great bunch of musicians on stage with me.
Well, Edgar Breaux, thank you so much for your time, and there's a core cult amount of people who are still geeked to have you in town.
Yeah, we're really excited about playing. The shows have been great.
So for those who have no idea what Simply Saucer is, would it be a fair characterization to say it's almost like the Velvet Underground of Canada is back together and playing in Bloomington Normal on Saturday night?
I'm not unhappy with that description, John, because I'm a big fan of the Velvet Underground. So yeah, let's go with that.
Edgar Breaux of the Canadian band Simply Saucer speaking with GLT's John Norton. Simply Saucer plays Reverberation Vinyl in Bloomington tomorrow night. Showtime is at 8 p.m. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. At our website, WGLT.org, you can find individual stories and interviews heard on Sound Ideas. Or look for the full episode or podcast with help today from Willis Kern, John Norton, and Colleen Reynolds. Share your thoughts about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our weekly political roundtable on President Trump in Asia, the Senate Republican tax plan, and allegations of sexual misconduct against Senate candidate Roy Moore. Moore's supporters say the Washington Post made the story up.
That's what I mean when I say opposition party, right? It's purely part of the apparatus of the Democratic Party. They don't make any bones about it.
Also, after authorities released the name of the Texas church shooter, how did Google handle false news reports?
Google's algorithm actually presumably started picking up on those results and reinforced them when people started clicking on these fake news reports.
Coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Comedian Louis C.K. says it's true that he was sexually inappropriate with several women whose accounts of his lewd actions were published in the New York Times. He has just released a statement in which he apologizes for his behavior. He acknowledges that he abused his power as a celebrity and apologized for the damage he caused to up-and-coming performers who had looked to him for guidance, as well as to the people who have supported him and his projects. A Marine Corps drill sergeant has been convicted of abusing young recruits, including several Muslim Americans. NPR's Greg Myrie reports one of the young recruits killed himself.
A military court found Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix guilty of punching, choking, kicking, and other abuses against more than a dozen recruits at boot camp in Parris Island, South Carolina. He picked on Muslims in particular, often calling them terrorists. In one instance, he ordered a Muslim recruit into an industrial drying machine, which was then turned on. Another recruit, Rahil Siddiqui, took his own life in March 2016 by jumping off a stairwell. His death prompted an investigation. The punishment for Sergeant Felix could include prison time and a dishonorable discharge. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The resignation of Lebanon's prime minister is raising tensions in the Middle East. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has the latest.
Saad Hariri may be the latest casualty in a rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia is unhappy that Iran has influence through the Lebanese group Hezbollah in Hariri's government. Some say they forced Hariri to resign. Saudi Arabia denies this. Whatever the truth, today a coalition of countries, including the US, France and Russia, asked that Lebanon be protected from this dangerous regional power struggle.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock reporting. Well, pressure is building on the retirement advice and investment firm TIAA following reports of a whistleblower case over its sales practices. NPR's Chris Arnold says there are now reports of a subpoena that's been issued by prosecutors in New York.
TIAA for decades was a nonprofit and a model of best practices. But then in the late 1990s, under pressure from Wall Street, Congress took away the company's nonprofit status. And former employees now say that after that, the company started putting profits first, even if that meant doing things that weren't right for the workers and retirees who trust the firm with their savings. For example, steering customers into higher cost mutual funds. All that is according to reporting by the New York Times, which now says that the New York Attorney General has issued a subpoena to the company related to its sales practices. In a statement, TIAA, which is a financial supporter of NPR, calls the Times reporting misleading and says it misrepresents the facts. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The Dow is down 42 points. This is NPR News. President Trump has shaken hands with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vietnam. However, the White House said the two leaders had not planned to meet one-on-one in a formal meeting. The brief exchange is raising eyebrows, though, because of a special counsel and congressional investigations into Russian interference in the U.S. presidential campaign and ongoing elections, or allegations, rather, of collusion with Trump's team. Pope Francis is hardening the Roman Catholic Church's position on nuclear weapons. He's challenging governments to stop stockpiling them, even as a deterrent. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports on the pontiff's cautionary remarks at a Vatican conference on nuclear